Skeptics Forum. And I'm curious, I see a lot of people I don't recognize. How many people have never been to one of our Skeptics Forums before? Wow, that's fabulous. Just two or three of you at random, tell me where you heard about it.
Church members.
Oh, very good. Very good. What's that? It's a friend of yours?
Yes.
Excellent. Welcome. And someone said something over? Mother. That's a good place to hear from it. You can trust your mother. Well, here's what we're going to do tonight. We are hoping to field some really excellent, tough questions about the Christian faith, about science, about philosophy, anything that deals with theology. We hope you brought some really good questions, not necessarily politically correct questions or easy questions, but the ones that have stumped you for a long time or maybe even have kept you from coming to faith. Those are the ones we want to hear. The means to do that is that microphone right there in the middle of the room. And the road to that microphone is that row of chairs right there. So if you're sitting back there, it means you're in line.
If you have a question, come back and have a seat. Mm-hmm.
That's right. That's right. That way you don't have to stand up, because sometimes the line can get lengthy.
Or car.
Yes, okay. I'm getting there.
Okay.
If you are shy to go to the mic, but you have a burning question, we have our own Carol Merrill back here in the name of Mark Perez in the burning shirt there. Raise your hand, Mark. Everybody say hi to Mark.
Hi, Mark.
Write your question down on a piece of paper, give it to Mark, and he will ask it in your stead. So that way you get your question answered. We try to do this about three times a year. It's very difficult to break into Dr. Ross's schedule and find a time that Dr. Ross has time and the church has time, but here we are. So welcome. We did this yesterday. We're doing it again today. It'll probably be 3 or 4 months before we do it again, but we do it on a regular basis. There's a couple of rules with the microphone. You may ask as many questions as you like, but if you have a second question, please go back to the end of the line, and Mark will enforce the rules. Mark knows the difference between two questions and a question that has 14 parts to it. There is no difference. That's the difference. Okay. We're going to go till 9 o'clock. About 8 o'clock, we are going to take a break and have a little drawing. So, those of you that are new, those of you that have been here forever, there's those cards on the chair. If you fill those out and give them to the lovely Diana over here, she will be passing around a box. We will put them in the box and do a drawing, and you, three of you, will get to pick among some of the RTB resources here. Speaking of Diana, Diana is running the book table over here. Say hi to Diana.
Hi, Diana.
A lot of reasons to believe material. A lot of Hugh Ross's material is over there. It's wonderful, just jam-packed with all kinds of cool treasures. So please take a look at that. Over there is the reason I know a lot of you came, is the free Lay's potato chips and tomatoes and all the really cool treats back there. So you're welcome to go back there and take advantage of that.
Drinks are on this side.
What's that?
And drinks are on this side.
And drinks are on that side. What more do you guys want? Okay. Tonight is sponsored by the Paradox Sunday School class, which is maybe the most unique Sunday School class in the entire planet, which is in this room every Sunday morning at 11:15. And Dr. Ross is the teacher of this class. He's been teaching Paradox class for 38 years. Wow. Only off by 5 years. Okay. If you love science and how it blends together with theology, and you just can't get enough of it like I can't, Paradox is the place for you to be. Tonight is also sponsored by the Los Angeles Chapter of Reasons to Believe, which is our own little secret club that we have that is not really part of Reasons to Believe, but we promote their material and learn from their videos and that kind of thing. And the LA Chapter of Reasons to Believe meets in this room at this time, 7 o'clock, on the first Monday of every month. So So again, if that's something you're interested in, you're welcome to come. So I want to introduce Dr. Hugh Ross. Hugh Ross is the president and founder of Reasons to Believe. He's a very popular speaker. We're very blessed to have him here with us tonight. Dr. Ross has a BA in physics from the University of British Columbia, a PhD in astronomy from the University of Toronto. He is a world-traveled speaker and the author of, I've lost count, but somewhere around 14 books, many of which, again, are over there on that book table. My name is Ross Hoagland, and I'm the moderator. And Dr. Ross is going to start us off with a few scientific, very recent scientific discoveries, and recent meaning like today or yesterday, not stuff you hear on the news that's already months old. And he will continue to speak until somebody gets up there at that mic. So if you brought a good question or have a good question, you better get over there because the line will get long pretty quick. So having said that,
we have a question, but why don't you let Dr.
Yeah, we're going to let him talk a little bit here.
That'd be a good idea, Ted. Yeah, thank you. Okay. So, Dr. Ross, would you open us with prayer, and then we'll start taking questions.
Father in heaven, we thank you for the privilege of being alive in the 21st century when so many discoveries are being made in the book of nature that shed light on what you're revealing in the book of Scripture. Guide and direct our time, Father. I pray there be good questions, and, Lord, that we have a really good dialogue with one another. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.
Well, when we did this yesterday, I talked about several discoveries that were published about planets and just how unique our planetary system is. And tonight I thought I would talk about a discovery concerning the entire universe. And people ask me, you know, who discovered the Big Bang? And yesterday there was someone that jumped up and says, oh, I know, that's George Lemaître, 1925. Roman Catholic monk was the first one to propose the Big Bang explanation for the universe. And some people have said, well, maybe the credit goes to Albert Einstein because he came up with the equations that predicted it way back in 1916 and 1917. But actually, the person who really deserves the credit for proposing the Big Bang for the first time is Job, quickly followed by Moses, Jeremiah, Isaiah, Zechariah, and King David, because it was Bible authors that told us that the universe can be traced back to a space-time beginning, where the universe expands from that space-time beginning, how it expands under laws of physics that don't change, where one of those laws is a pervasive law of decay, which implies that we must be living in a universe that's not only getting bigger and bigger as time goes by, continuously expanding, but it's also continuously getting colder and colder as it gets older and older. And literally until the 20th century, no book of history, science, or theology was making these kinds of statements about the universe. And when the Big Bang was first proposed, a number of astronomers and physicists strongly reacted because they recognized it pointed to the God of the Bible. So for about a 40-year period, they were trying to find some way to conceive of the universe where it wouldn't have these characteristics. But what happened over the past 60, 70 years is that progressively astronomers developed more and more tests of the Big Bang. But atheists in particular kept coming up with challenges of the Big Bang. And one of those challenges just got resolved in the January 20th issue of the Astrophysical Journal a few days ago. And the challenge has been this, is that the Big Bang model explains or predicts that in the first 4 minutes after the cosmic creation event, about 25% of all the hydrogen in the universe will be fused into helium. And you'll get about 0.01% fused into deuterium. Everybody know what deuterium is?
Yeah.
That's heavy hydrogen, made famous during World War II, because that's how they were able to come up with the atomic bomb, one of the tools they use. But deuterium is basically hydrogen where you not only have a proton, you've got a neutron. So it's a proton and a neutron together. So that's why they call it heavy hydrogen compared to ordinary hydrogen, which just has a single proton. And so according to the Big Bang, there's this tiny percentage of the total amount of ordinary matter that gets converted into deuterium. And by the way, that's the only source of deuterium. Stars don't make deuterium. In fact, stars consume deuterium. And so There's been two ways that you can measure the deuterium abundance. So the Big Bang model predicts that you're going to get a certain amount of deuterium in the cosmic creation event. And one way you can measure that deuterium abundance, and by the way, the deuterium abundance tells you how much ordinary matter that is in the universe. So if you know the abundance of deuterium, you know the total amount of electrons, protons, and neutrons in the universe. That's something else that's in the Big Bang model. There's a very strong correlation between the two. But that's how we determine how much ordinary matter there is in the universe. That's the most direct way, is simply to measure the abundance of what we call primordial deuterium. Say, what's primordial deuterium? That's deuterium that exists in the universe before stars start burning. Once stars start burning, they begin to consume deuterium. So it's not just as easy as measuring deuterium in the sun. If you measure deuterium in the sun, you're going to get an underestimate. You want to really look at objects so far away that you're looking back so far back in time that star burning is not a significant factor. The problem there is that if you're looking that far away, the deuterium spectral lines are incredibly weak. And really, it's only been with the coming into service of the double Keck telescope and what they call the very large telescope. A double Keck telescope is two 33-foot diameter optical telescopes that sit on top of Mauna Kea in Hawaii. And until recently, it had the largest collecting area of any optical telescope. But the European Southern Observatory a few years back brought online what they call the very large telescope. And it's four 8.2-meter telescopes. That's about a 27-foot diameter telescope, but there's four of them. So actually, these four telescopes linked together have a larger collecting area than the Keck telescope. Well, what happened in the January 20th issue is a team of astronomers looked for the deuterium spectral lines in a very distant gas cloud that was in front of a quasar. Now, I remember when I was a student, they were trying to find this deuterium in quasars. Quasars are very bright and very far away. But the problem is quasars have a lot of stars. And so what they've been doing is looking for huge clouds that sit in front of a quasar. Now, these, what they call, they're called, Lyman alpha, damped Lyman alpha clouds. That's a technical term, which means they're in the process of collapsing to make galaxies, which means they really don't have stars in them yet. But because they don't have stars in them, they're incredibly faint. And there's no way you can see deuterium in an isolated damped Lyman alpha cloud. What you do is you try to find one that's sitting right in front of a quasar. And what you do is you look for the absorption. In other words, this cloud in front of the quasar actually absorbs some of the light of the quasar behind it. And so you get these absorption spectral lines, which tells you how much deuterium is actually in that cloud that's right in front of the quasar. Now, which means you've got to be lucky enough to have one of these clouds in front of a distant, very bright quasar. And there's not that many of them, but they found a few, and until now, they've not been able to get good observations of one that's far enough away where they know star formation is not a significant factor. In fact, what we see here in this paper is the first time that any astronomy team's been able to get an accurate measure of the deuterium abundance in an object that's more than 11 billion light years away. Now, if it's more than 11 billion light years away, that means it's only 3 or 4 billion years after the cosmic creation event. And therefore, since it's still collapsing to make a galaxy, there aren't a lot of stars in there to mess things up. Now, they were able to publish a figure that was accurate to four places of the decimal. But for a long time, we've been able to independently get this deuterium abundance by looking at the temperature fluctuations in the cosmic background radiation. It's an indirect method, but it's a method we've been able to do with quite high precision. And it gave us a number that was published just this last March. The Planck satellite is the most detailed map of the cosmic background radiation and was sufficiently sophisticated they could get an accurate measure of this deuterium abundance. But it was indirect, and astronomers wanted a second check. Let's get a direct method using totally different instruments, because there's a lot of discussion in the astrophysical literature. I mean, maybe there's selection effects based on the instruments we're using. But now we got two independent measures observing completely different things using completely different instruments. And what got published in this paper is two figures accurate to fourth place of the decimal, and they agree to the fourth place of the decimal. So it's a phenomenal demonstration of the reliability and trustworthiness of a major prediction of Big Bang cosmology. In fact, I've been looking at this for the past 20, 30 years, looking at all the possible tests of the Big Bang creation model we can make. This is the last test that has been proposed that can be done. So it's like, hey, you know, you've been waiting for 30 years to make this test, and just this past January, the test has been done, and the Big Bang model has passed it with flying colors. So it's a dramatic demonstration that what the Bible predicted thousands of years ago is right on target. Yes.
Yeah. Which optical instrument was used to get this direct observation of this absorption line?
Well, what the team did is they did observations at the Keck Double Telescope, where you got two 10-meter diameter telescopes, and they did it again using the Very Large Telescope in Chile, where you got four 8.2-meter telescopes. Those are the two largest optical instruments in the world, but they used a combination of both of them, because one of them was good to make measurements in winter, the other one was good to make measurements in summer, and they got a lot of telescope time, but it took all that telescope time on these very big telescopes to get sufficient sensitivity to get a number that they could compare with what they get from the Planck satellite. And, you know, I can give you the numbers. It's remarkably close. You know, it works out to 4.73% of the universe is made up of protons, neutrons, and electrons, according to this deuterium spectral line measurement, which compares with 4.72 that you get from the Planck satellite. So, and it's actually a little bit closer than that. I mean, it's like 4.726 compared to 4.731, so it's very close. And well within the error bars. So, as of a couple of weeks ago, the Big Bang creation model has passed another very definitive test. Okay.
A question. There was an article that came out in mainstream news media a couple of weeks ago that I read, and the scientists seem rather arrogant, in my opinion. They did studies of camel bones at one mine in the Holy Land and came to the conclusion that there were no camels in biblical times, period. I'm a novice, you know, archaeologist, but I don't know. I was wondering if you had read that article and how they could come with such a sweeping conclusion, you know, that the whole Middle East didn't have camels based on one camel study and one mine in one Holy Land.
Yeah, I did read the article, and what it demonstrates is that there's a reasonable probability that camels were absent from that region at that time. Now, it doesn't mean there were never camels in that region. It just means that at that particular time period, that region was relatively vacant of camels. You can't say there were no camels, but the fact that we're not finding a lot of fossils tells us that the population couldn't have been that great. On the other hand, we know that camels are reasonably ubiquitous over the face of the earth. If you look before the advent of humanity, there were camels here in North America, camels in South America, camel-like creatures in Australia. They were everywhere. When human beings showed up, they began to go extinct in large numbers. So, for example, when humans invaded North and South America, the camels quickly disappeared. A lot of people think that they ate them. Other people think, well, maybe there was some kind of climate disaster that wiped them out, or it might have been a combination of human hunting. What we do seem to recognize is that the early humans quickly discovered the easiest meat to get is to go after the really big mammals. And so, for example, here in North America, there were horses, there were mastodons, there were camels, and
three-toed sloths.
Right. And those creatures were quickly wiped out. Literally within 1,000 years, they were all gone. That also happened in Australia, happened in South America as well. And so if you got serious predation by human beings going on in the Middle East, that could lead to a temporary extinction of the camels in that region, or a near extinction. Where the article is suspect is that people reading at least the popular version might get the idea that camels were never in that region. No, camels weren't there in large numbers at that particular time. And the real speculation by the scholars is what would cause that to happen. And, the article I read said maybe there is a severe drought. Camels can handle desert regions, but there's a limit to what they can handle. They can go a month without water, but if it's kind of a drought like we're having right now, that could be more serious.
Or the miners got hungry and ate the camels, another possibility.
Yeah, I mean, if the people there were needing liquid, knocking off a camel would give you some liquid. So,
well, we got a question here. Go ahead, Ted.
Yes, hello. This question spans several passages in the Bible dealing with giants and the sons of God. The first, of course, would be Genesis 6. The second is Numbers 13, with Moses' spies coming back
right. And
giving a report that we saw the Nephilim, and we became like grasshoppers on our own sight, and so we were in their sight. And then King Og in Deuteronomy, whose bed was 13 and a half feet long and 6 feet wide, made out of iron. And then in Genesis 6, you have a cryptic description of the days before the flood. It said, the sons of God saw the daughters of men were beautiful, and they took to wives for themselves whomever they chose. Then the Lord said, my spirit shall not always strive with man forever, because he is also flesh. Nevertheless, his days will be 120 years. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men, and they bore children to them. These were the mighty men of old. And the key feature here is not only in the days of Noah, and also afterward. And you ended up with this Og character, and the Jews being afraid to take the land from these big guys. And Joshua and Caleb drove out giants from his territory when he was 85 years old. Now, I don't know how big the giants were, but for an 85-year-old guy, it's pretty remarkable. And then, of course, the most famous giant of all, Goliath, who's said to be 9 feet tall. So I want to hear your take on these things. I have my own machinations and thoughts, but I want to get your thoughts.
Well, good question, and it comes up quite frequently. In fact, there's a couple of very well-known Bible preachers that are speaking on this right now. So I got a book coming out in early March called Navigating Genesis, and there's a chapter in the book that deals with the question of the Nephilim, where I basically lay out three different interpretations of who these Nephilim are and give you the best evidence for all three positions, and let you make up your own mind. But what I do to try to help you make up your own mind is actually give you every single verse in the Bible that talks about sons of God and children of God, contrasted with sons of men and children of men, and also another study where I look at son of God versus son of man. And the principle there is, what you quickly discover is that the title, sons of God, is only given in the Bible to human beings who have been baptized in the Holy Spirit. So not until the day of Pentecost does any believer take the title Son of God. Now the word term sons of God can also refer to angels. So in the book of Job it talks about sons of God, but these are angelic beings. And there's one verse in the Old Testament where it actually refers to humans as sons of God, but it's a prophecy. It's in the book of Hosea where it tells the Jewish believers there will come a day when they will become sons of God. They're not sons of God yet. And likewise, what you see is that in the New Testament, Jesus refers to himself exclusively as a son of man in the Gospels. In the epistles, he's exclusively referred to as a son of God. So he doesn't take the title son of God until after he's resurrected and the Holy Spirit comes down and fills his disciples. And at that point forward, the followers of Jesus Christ are never called sons of men. They're only called sons of God. Whereas before the day of Pentecost, they're only called sons of men. They're never called sons of God. So when it says in Genesis 6, the sons of God came and visited the daughters of men and had children by them, and these were the Nephilim, that's why a lot of people think these sons are the sons of God have to be angelic beings, just based on this word study. And then another rationale there, what I put in the book actually is a little section called The Physics of Basketball. Those of you basketball fans may appreciate that the ease with which you can sink a basket goes up with the square of your height, which explains why these NBA basketball teams are so eager to get seven-footers. A seven-footer will get twice as many baskets as a five-footer if they have equal skill. However, what you do notice in the NBA, your best players are not 7 feet tall. Your best players come in between about 6'5" and 6'8". Why? Because once you get past about 6.5 feet tall, you begin to lose mobility. And those of you who were Lakers fans, say, 10 years ago, may remember Shaquille O'Neal lumbering down the court. The rest of the team would be there a few seconds ahead of him. They'd wait for him to come down. He didn't have the mobility they had. And so, but he had the height, so he can get in front of the basket, take a pass, and dunk a basket. But what they've also noticed is that once you get past 7.5 feet tall, the loss of mobility becomes quite extreme. For example, I got to meet a Christian actor who was 7'7.5". He played the role of Jaws in one of those James Bond movies. Yeah, you may remember that. Yeah. Today he's in a wheelchair. He's not able to walk. And that's because of his great height that he's lost that mobility. So the tallest human that's ever lived was 8'11". You don't get past 8 feet unless you've got a glandular disorder. There's a rare glandular disorder where your body just keeps growing. But what happens is you grow to a point where you die. And so people who are over 8 feet tall don't live very long because, you know, eventually they get so tall that the mobility loss becomes catastrophic and they die. So, but what you brought up there at the microphone is that these Nephilim were not short people. Goliath is the shortest of all the Nephilim mentioned in the Bible. And if you use a short cubit, it says he was 6 cubits tall, 6 cubits in a span. If you use the shortest possible measures of a cubit in a span, he's 9'9". If you use the long cubit, he's about 12 feet tall. And then you mentioned the one about Og, the king of Bashan, who hit a bed that by the short cubit was 13 feet long and 6 feet wide. By the long cubit, it was over 15 feet long. And it was made out of iron, so this guy evidently weighed a bit. But the problem there is that they can't be purely human. They're just too tall. And moreover, it says of Goliath that he was mobile. He was able to go into battle. And again, this is a minimum because it tells you in Samuel, 1 Samuel, the weight of armor and weapons that Goliath took into battle. And if you use the most conservative estimates for those weights, it was 250 pounds minimum that he took into battle. Now, if you're a human, you wouldn't be able to do it. Wouldn't be able to carry that much weight. Also says he was a mighty warrior, so he could move around all right. So there was something superhuman about Goliath, as well as the other Nephilim, which explains why when the Jews came into the Promised Land, they were terrified of these Nephilim. I mean, they were very tall, very capable, very strong, and quite terrifying. We were like grasshoppers in their eyes. So... Now, the other thing you notice about the Nephilim, and in this chapter I'm writing, I actually give you all the passages, is that all the Nephilim mentioned in the Bible are men. There are no female Nephilim mentioned. And also you notice that they have birth defects, 6 fingers and 6 toes. So that tells us that there's a genetic issue with the Nephilim, which is something you expect if Jude 6 indeed is referring to angels that left their estate. And actually, if you look at that in the Greek, it's a reference that's very akin to bestiality. And basically, you see in Jude 6, as God is saying, the angels that left their estate are consigned to the abyss. And the abyss is a very terrifying prison house for a certain category of demons. And when Jesus was casting out demons in the gospel accounts, the demons also always said after they got cast out, "Do not send us to the abyss." Jesus didn't send any of them to the abyss. He recognized that they were not so evil as these other angels who left their estate and had sexual intercourse with women. So that's the favorite interpretation of the sons of God and the Nephilim. Another interpretation is that, wait a minute, it tells us in the Bible that angels don't marry. Well, it's a reference to the righteous angels, not necessarily to the demons. And also, when it says they don't marry, it doesn't say that they cannot marry.
Right.
But that is a debate. Some people say, well, maybe angels are not capable of having sexual intercourse with women. I can tell you this from my own personal experience with encounters with demons. They seem to be, without exception, obsessed about sexual immorality. Whenever I encounter demonic activity, sexual immorality is just way up there. It seems like that's the only thing on their mind, which tells me that, you know, they must have some sexual capability to be that obsessed with sex, and particularly perverted sex. So I personally favor the interpretation that they really are angels, fallen angels that came down and intercourse with women. But another interpretation, a third interpretation, is demon-possessed men. But then you got the problem, how do you explain the great height? So anyway, that's kind of what you're going to see, the highlights will be in the book Navigating Genesis. By the way, there are preachers today saying the Nephilim have come back in the 21st century.
I've heard some.
Right. I would... Mainly, one reason why I wrote that chapter is to make it clear from a biblical perspective that's not true. The Nephilim were wiped out. The last of the Nephilim were wiped out by David's mighty men. God rose up David and his mighty men to eliminate the last of the Nephilim. Okay, go ahead.
Mr. Ross, Dr. Ross, hello. The Lord Jesus Christ speaks of in the four Gospels, he told the Pharisees that he was going to destroy the temple and after 3 days he was going to rise it again. The Apostle John speaks of, in Revelation 21, the new temple that's in Jerusalem after the new creation of the heavens and the earth. The Lord Jesus Christ is that temple. I looked in the cross-references to the footnotes, and it gives a reference to Ezekiel chapter 40 through 48 about the dynamics and the measurement of the new temple. Could you comment on what they're cross-referencing and what the meaning behind that is, please?
Well, I remember a few days ago I was doing a public event and somebody asked me in the audience, is there any part of the Bible you don't yet fully understand? Can you give me an example? And I said, yeah, Ezekiel 40 to 48. So, and The issue with Ezekiel 40 to 48, it seems to be talking about many different temples. You know, as I've tried to carefully read it, it's like it seems to me it's referring to three different temples, some of which may be literal. I'm convinced that at least some of them are literal, but it's quite possible that one or two of them might be figurative. So I really don't have that figured out. Now, where I think you might be able to go with it is when you look in Revelation 21 and 22, it refers to the new heavens, the new earth, and the new Jerusalem. And it's a realm that is not like this universe. It's got completely different physics, completely different dimensions. And that's where the followers of God are going to spend eternity. And so it refers to this as a brand new creation. But there's a single sentence there where it talks about God creating kingdoms. And it's quite possible that what God is going to do in the new creation is create other spiritual beings in addition to the angels and the human beings he's already created. And perhaps Ezekiel 40 to 48 may have something to do with that. Now, all that speculation, I don't know what the text means by kingdoms. some people have come to me and said, does that mean there's going to be animals in the new creation? Because, you know, it's quite clear from Ezekiel, or pardon me, Ecclesiastes and other passages, our pets aren't going to be with us in heaven. But maybe God will create a whole new set of pets, maybe better pets. I can think of one pet I'm looking forward to being replaced, but...
I have a question about promoting a biblical creation model and a testable model that gets out to the world to be explained. And it goes to, I enjoyed watching your panel discussion with Dwayne Gish and Eugenie Scott. And I don't know if Eugenie Scott is still as influential in kind of national writing of curriculum for public school education. It's not a problem for my family because we put our kids through Christian education. But I, as far as I have an impression, secular education is still devoid of mention of an alternate model for explaining origins. And what I took away from the debate, just trying to read Eugenie Scott's body language, was that she wasn't very open to what you were saying. But I'd like you to remark about, you know, what did you take away from that panel discussion and any conversation with her, and where do you see RTB interfacing, putting that model out for consideration by textbook writers?
Right. That debate took place in the late 1990s, so it's been a while. Yeah, Eugenie Scott has just stepped down from being the CEO of the National Center for Science Education. Not really. She's the chairman of the board, but she's hired someone else to kind of do the day-to-day work of the National Center for Science Education. She's an atheist. She's very public about her atheism, and she's adamant that there not be any hint of creationism or the existence of God in public education science curricula. Yeah, so she's quite aggressive about that. They kind of see their organization as an organization to promote Darwinism and to defeat creationism. I mean, they're quite... and they kind of look at creationism as the great threat to America. So we need to rid our country of that kind of belief system. However, I've had quite a few conversations with her. We've actually had her on our TV show. She likes reasons to believe, and that she appreciates the fact that we're not trying to distort science. And so she at least respects the fact that we're following the scientific method. We're using a scientific model. And she prefers to kind of, you know, throw all of her arrows at young earth creationism and the intelligent design movement. Has been very critical of the intelligent design movement as being a creationist movement without a model. She said publicly, at least the young earth creationists have a model. It's a failed model, but at least they have a model, whereas the intelligent design movement, there is no model. And, you know, when I've been dialoguing with her, both on our show and her venues, she hasn't really been that critical of the model we presented. She thinks we're wrong, but she doesn't come up with any evidence for why we're wrong.
More passive-aggressive
Yeah, and her demeanor is much more pleasant towards us. So, I mean, I've never seen her be mean-spirited. And in fact, I think if you watch that debate, and by the way, it's online. You can watch it for free. We put it out there online. I think you can see the difference in her demeanor towards me than, say, towards Dwayne Gish.
Yeah, she only threw one bar, which was what I witnessed was you were giving a lot of footnotes in the creation. She threw one bar about people using quotes by somebody else. Because I she seemed to kind of wrangle a little bit that you were too successful in using her side to argue against her worldview.
I was trying. So, but that battle is still going on in terms of the textbook battles. In fact, I'm on their mailing list. I watch what they're doing, and they're very aggressive in trying to make sure that high school textbooks do not have any hint of creationism or this idea that God exists or that there's alternate models. Now, if you look at the college-level curricula, what you will see in college textbooks in evolutionary biology is that they're quite open to alternatives to Darwinian evolution. but the alternatives that they're open to are other atheistic models, like the model coming up in the Santa Fe Institute, where they're claiming that there's hidden laws of physics that spontaneously make life from non-life and actually spontaneously generate complexity from simplicity. But Stuart Kaufman, who still heads up the Santa Fe Institute, admits that he has zero evidence for what he proposes. But, you know, a few years back, Stuart Kaufman gave a lecture at Caltech to the scientific community there. And for the first half hour of his talk, he just destroyed the Darwinian model, basically showing mathematically it doesn't work. And he's got a point. If all you've got is 3.8 billion years, that simply isn't enough time to get something like advanced life by naturalistic process. And he also points out that Darwinian principles always favor simplicity over complexity. Life should get simpler, not more complex. The fact that it becomes more complex, he argues, is a defeater for Darwinian evolution. In the second half of his talk, he talked about the fourth law of thermodynamics, a law of physics that actually goes the opposite of the second law of thermodynamics. But the fastest way to get your patent rejected by the U.S. Patent Office is to have an invention that violates the second law of thermodynamics. And by the way, the pervasive rule of the second law of thermodynamics is essential for life to exist in the universe. That's one thing we see. Everywhere you look in the universe, the second law operates. And it operates at an extremely high level of entropy. Stuart Kaufman claims that the second law allows for exotic sites where you've got a fourth law of thermodynamics. But that would actually rule out the possibility of life. And by the way, we astronomers don't see any exotic sites. Go ahead.
Good evening. I've got here that I got from a magazine the other day. You might have heard of it. It's a they found a an intact 1.1 million year old skull in the Republic of Georgia.
Right.
And it says it offers stunning evidence that early human evolution may have been simpler than previously thought. That's what you're talking about. Simpler, the simpler, the better. Is that what you meant? So the oldest complete skull of an adult early Homo ever just uncovered. It has a combination of attributes, a long face, large teeth, and a tiny brain case. Long considered earmarks of different hominids.
Right.
Had the parts been been found separately at different sites in Africa, they might have been attributed to different species, said one of the paleoanthropologists. Instead, the skull suggests that specimens previously identified as Homo ergaster, Homo rudolfensis, and Homo habilis are all part of a single Homo species that spread through Africa before migrating to Eurasia.
Right.
So, doesn't this kind of... you would think that things like this would have stopped the creation of 6,000 years old, that the Earth is 6,000 years old. What can you say to these people that will make them quit believing in that? I mean, what can you do that to that? I mean, why haven't we found fossils of the Nephilim? If they had big, long femurs, I mean, we would have found them somewhere. Okay.
Well, okay. As far as finding the fossils of the Nephilim, there weren't that many around. And, you know, unless you get efficient burial of a skeleton, it quickly decays. And so we don't find a lot of human skeletons, period, you know, because in a couple hundred years, the bones are gone. What it takes is some kind of, very catastrophic deposit where you cut off all the oxygen and bacteria from the bones, and then the bones can be preserved. But hey, if you're only talking, say, a few dozen or a few hundred Nephilim running around, the probability of getting fossilized remains is virtually zero. So it's not all surprising we don't have fossil remains of the Nephilim. As far as this find in Georgia of a million-year-old hominid species, My colleague, Fuz Rana, who's our staff biochemist, has done a number of articles and podcasts on that. You'll find that on our website. He's the expert on this stuff. I can simply comment what I've heard Fuz say to our staff is that it's generated a debate. Is this a separate species, or is it simply a subset of a larger population? And yeah, you're right. It's causing people to wonder, maybe Homo ergaster and Homo heidelbergensis and Homo rudolfensis are not separate species. You know, it's kind of like people here. We all kind of look different, and our brain sizes are different. And maybe we're looking at a single species instead of multiple species. The discovery in Georgia did not settle that debate. It simply added fuel to the debate. Where it was very disturbing to the evolutionists is you've got this creature that's a million years old with a small brain.
Almost 2 million years old.
Yeah, and it's like, okay, if we're the product of common descent from a common ancestor with the apes, you'd expect the bipedal capability would get more and more progressed with respect to time, and that the brain capacity would be a linear function of growth with respect to time. Particularly in the last 3 years with the new hominid finds they're finding, it's showing that's not the case. The brain size goes up and down. It's not kind of a linear progression. And likewise, bipedal capability is not linear. It's going up and down, which has caused a number of anthropologists to conclude every time we find a new fossil or what we think is a new species, it throws our evolutionary models into greater chaos, not less chaos. So that's kind of the gist of what you're going to hear from Fuz Rana in the podcast and the articles that he's written. And he's also written some material where he thinks the research is going to go from here on in. But I think you've heard me say this before. It's a good thing that God created all these bipedal primate species, because as those continents that had those bipedal primate species that have the highest survival rate of large-bodied bird and mammal species. You heard me just say a few minutes ago, Australia has lost almost all of its large-bodied bird and mammal species. Here in North and South America, we had camels and horses and mastodons, and now they're all gone. And that's why the Indians and the Eskimos were never able to get out of the Stone Age. They lacked the animals they needed to launch themselves out of the Stone Age. But the problem with North and South America and Australia, we have zero evidence that those continents ever had bipedal primate species that predated human beings, whereas Africa, Europe, and Asia did. Africa had the most, and in Africa, the extinction rate when humans arrived for large-bodied bird and mammal species was only 4%, contrasted with Australia, where it was 90%. So thank God for the bipedal primates.
Let me say something to Al. As far as what do you say to someone who takes a young Earth perspective, they're going to put a lot more credence in the Bible than they are in the findings of science. So what you need to do is find your evidence in the Bible. So my answer to you, Al, is study your Bible.
Well,
study your Bible.
By the way, I've debated young Earth creationists frequently, and you can watch some of the debates on our website at reasons.org. And in fact, the debate between Ken Ham and Bill Nye was a classic example of how not to do a debate, because you got Ken Ham basically saying science doesn't matter, only the Bible matters, only the Bible is trustworthy, and Bill Nye basically saying the opposite, science is our only reliable guide to truth. And both men talked to their constituents. They did not talk to one another or to the constituents of one another. And they never really engage one another, which is why I was so pleased. I think you were there at the debate that I had with Deborah Harzma, an evolutionary biologist who's the president of the BioLogos, because we didn't have opening statements. We basically sat in two armchairs and talked to one another for the entire time, then fielded questions from the audience afterwards. We're actually engaging one another, asking one another questions, and that's really how a debate should be done.
It was kind of refreshing. We're going to do one more question, but after this question, we're going to take our break and do our drawing. So if you haven't filled your card out yet, please do so while this question's going on. And Diana, you want to pass around the magic box there. So go ahead with the next question.
Is there any way that you can prove that Adam and Eve were the first humans on the earth?
Well, you should have come to that evening we had with Deborah Harzma, because she heads up an organization where they believe that humans are descended from thousands, not two. And I defended the view that it was two, not thousands. And, you know, what kind of evidence can you come up with? Well, the Bible is quite clear that we're descended from just two, not thousands. But in terms of the scientific evidence, a few tools you can use is to look at the DNA evidence, which is consistent, doesn't prove, but is consistent with all of humanity being descended from one woman and one man that lived in one location a few tens of thousands of years ago. That few tens of thousands of years ago is consistent with our best attempts to calibrate the Genesis 5 and 11 genealogies, where we can come up with a date for when God created Adam and Eve. Another way you can get at it, very crude, is to look at what are called the cultural big bangs, where you got clothing being used and jewelry and advanced tools, art, music, and religious expression. Those all suddenly appear in the scene, and they appear at a date that's consistent with the mitochondrial DNA date, the Y chromosome DNA date, as well as with the biblical date. One reason why I'm critical of this idea that genomics proves that we're descended from thousands of individuals and not just two is that is a theoretical calculation, not an experimental result. Basically, if people are looking at the DNA differentiation humans alive today, and then they measure a current mutation rate of change in our DNA, and by that means, assuming an evolutionary model, they calculate an ancestral population, which comes up with anywhere from 800 to 10,000 individuals, depending what mutation rate you assume. But the problem is you're assuming the mutation rate has never changed. And the real problem is that we've done experiments of real time with known mutation rates, where, for example, you put a couple of animals, a male and a female, on a deserted island, let them reproduce for 5, 10, 20 generations, then measure their DNA differentiation and compare it with the theoretical predictions. Every single time that's been done, the DNA differentiation you measure is far greater than what the models predict. So on that basis, I would argue that the genomics model's derivation that were descended from 1,200 individuals or 800 individuals is an upper estimate. It's not an actual number. It can't be more than that, but it could certainly be a lot less, all the way down to two.
James, why don't you go ahead?
In Zechariah chapter 14, well, the whole book, to my understanding, Zechariah, one of the minor prophets, is his message in his book is apocalyptic and futuristic. And what it seems to me in verse 12 of chapter 14, it explains how Jerusalem is going to be, there's going to have security in Jerusalem, and there's going to be a plague that the Lord will strike on the people who have gone to war against Jerusalem, the neighboring nations, enemies of Israel. It says their flesh will rot while they stand on their feet, and their eyes will rot in their sockets, and their tongues will rot in their mouth. And to corroborate with this, in Revelation chapter 16, it talks about lightning and peals of thunder and, war and whatnot. My question is with Russia, Iran, Korea, and there's a lot of concern about nuclear technology and nuclear war and everything else going on in the world. Could this be indicative of what Zechariah and John's talking about as far as the consequences from maybe possibly an atomic bomb or radiation from nuclear germ warfare or whatnot?
Okay.
That's my question.
Yeah. Well, Zechariah 14 is definitely apocalyptic. It's referring to events just before the return of Jesus to planet Earth. And he returns to put an end to the wickedness of the peoples on the face of the earth. And basically comes to save humanity from self-extermination. Because everybody is at war, and they've got, you know, incredible weaponry, and they're literally in danger of self-extermination. And I'll just read the text here. And by the way, there's a very important cross-reference to this, which basically answers your question. But this is what it says in Zechariah 14, 12 down to 15. This is the plague with which the Lord will strike all the nations that fought against Jerusalem. Their flesh will rot while they are still standing on their feet. Their eyes will rot out of their sockets, and their tongues will rot in their mouths. On that day, men will be stricken by the Lord with great panic. Each man will seize the hand of another, and they'll attack each other. Judah, too, will fight at Jerusalem. The wealth of all the surrounding nations will be collected, great quantities of gold and silver and clothing. A similar plague will strike the horses and mules, the camels and donkeys, and all the animals in those camps. That's Ezekiel 14. A good cross-reference would be, that's Zechariah 14. A good cross-reference is Ezekiel 39. And Ezekiel 39 refers to the last great war before the return of Christ, and makes reference to the fact that there will be these nations that will attack Israel, the newborn nation of Israel that was formed in 1948. And when they come around Israel, it's very similar to this text. It basically says that their flesh will be destroyed, but that all of their armaments and their material and durable goods will be intact. And that the victorious Israelis will collect all the booty from the camps of their enemies. And so nothing's going to happen to their war material. It's simply the flesh that gets destroyed. But the other interesting insight you see in Ezekiel 39 is that the Israelis wait 7 months before they bury the bodies of their enemies, which is where people have gotten the idea maybe it's radioactive, and therefore the bodies are not safe to deal with until the radioactivity level drops. But I would argue it can't be atomic bombs or hydrogen bombs, because it would destroy all the war material.
Okay.
So evidently this is something that does damage to living tissue, but doesn't affect things like steel and aluminum and plastic. That's all intact, and people are able to collect all that. And, you know, I spoke on this literally 30 years ago, making the point that this kind of description you see here in Zechariah 14 and Ezekiel 39 fits well a fairly advanced neutron bomb. A neutron bomb is actually classified as a non-nuclear device because there's really no explosion. It's a device that basically showers neutrons. And those neutrons basically destroy protein. And so any creature that's got a lot of protein in it will be wiped out. Now, unless it's a very sophisticated neutron bomb, the cockroaches do quite fine. Because, you know, they're not like us with a lot of protein. They've got this kind of shell, and they're quite impervious to that kind of radiation. So it's kind of chilling to think the cockroaches will survive, but the horses and the camels and the donkeys and human beings won't.
Neutron bomb. Thank you very much, Dr. Ross.
Okay.
Could it also be a chemical weapon of some kind? It sounds like it.
Some have speculated it would be a chemical weapon, but the problem is that there would be a chemical residue, and it tells us that right away they're able to take, you know, take control of all the material and armaments that are left behind. And by the way, a neutron bomb would be a wise use of Israel's limited nuclear stockpile. You know, they've got a relatively small nuclear reactor, and on the assumption that they've been collecting weapon-grade material for, say, 30, 40 years, they still wouldn't have a lot. They could probably turn that into half a dozen atomic bombs, at most maybe a dozen, but it'd be a much more efficient use of that material to turn it into neutron bombs, because you'd be able to get a lot of neutron bomb capability with that. And by the way, there is some speculation that our military here in the United States is working on what's called a perfect neutron bomb. What's a perfect neutron bomb? Well, the neutron bomb was invented in 1960. But to get the shower of neutrons, they had to have a fission event, which was basically a really tiny atomic device that allows a huge shower of neutrons to go forward. But that little bit of fissionable activity means you get radioactivity. It's also possible, if you've got the sophistication, technological sophistication, to make a neutron bomb where there's no radiation at all. And that's a device that would literally be classified as non-nuclear, because there is no nuclear fission or fusion going on at all, and yet you get this huge shower of neutrons. But that would require a level of quite sophisticated technology, and there is some speculation that black ops here in the U.S. are actually working on that kind of device. But back in 1960, the relatively cheap neutron bomb was invented. It was invented here in the United States, but literally any nation that's got sufficient nuclear material could make that. Iran and North Korea could do that right now if they wanted to. Maybe they have. But I wouldn't put it past the Israelis that they've already done it, because they're very secretive about their nuclear program, whether they have one or not. They've always denied that they've had one. But, you know, they could quite honestly deny that they've got nuclear weapons by just saying, well, you know, from their perspective, neutron bombs wouldn't be in that category. So I think what's fascinating, we live in a day and an age when all this apocalyptic literature we see here in the Bible could actually be fulfilled. When I was a young boy, the technology didn't exist. It exists now.
Jocelyn?
Okay, this is in a totally different question.
Hopefully.
Would you explain again why when the polar caps, I'm talking about that, the ice is building up in the Antarctic and it's melting in the Arctic, and why the melting of the ice, and I know that you have the circulation of the waters in the Atlantic bringing the warmer waters up north, how does that trigger potentially the next ice age?
Well, there are climatologists who are speculating that the melting of the polar ice cap will lead to a new ice age. But it's not a well-established model. It's a possibility. So I don't want to give you the idea that this is a done deal. But the scenario is like this, that with warm water coming in from the Arctic, and the Arctic ice cap, literally in the last 50 years, has shrunk by a factor of two. It's only half the size it was 50 years ago. Not too surprising, because the polar ice cap's only about 6 feet thick. So a little bit of heat can do a lot of melting. But the problem is, when you shrink the polar ice cap, you now have exposed ocean liquid water. And it also could speed up the elimination of the polar ice cap, because instead of you having ice reflecting sunlight to outer space, you've got liquid water, which isn't as reflective as ice, and therefore absorbs more heat and speeds up the melting of the polar ice cap. You say, how come that's not happening in Antarctica? Well, people have pointed out that a lot of coal dust is falling on the polar ice cap, and it's black, and so that's helping to absorb heat, whereas we're not seeing anywhere near the coal dust accumulating in Antarctica. So it seems to be impacting. It makes good sense, because look where all the heavy industry is. It's in the northern hemisphere. So, and it's really sped up now that China is consuming. China is now the number one consumer of coal in the world. And most of the coal we're seeing in the Arctic ice cap is from China. So that could be a factor speeding it up. But how it could lead to an ice age is, now you've got open liquid water, and as sunlight falls on that open liquid water, it evaporates. And now you've got the potential for snow to fall on Siberia and northern Canada. And right now, those are deserts. Both Siberia and northern Canada get less than 10 inches of precipitation per year. But if the Arctic polar cap is gone, that precipitation could go up to 20 inches a year. And if it goes up to 20 inches a year, then you've got snow that's going to accumulate. Even if the temperature goes up 2 or 3 degrees, it's so cold in the interior of Canada and Siberia that even with a rising temperature, you would get accumulating snow. The only reason why snow doesn't accumulate there now is that the precipitation is at a desert level. Put it up to 20 inches, you've got an ice age. You're going to get a couple of thousand feet of ice covering Canada and Siberia and a good chunk of northern Europe. And what we see in the ice core drills is every time the temperature of the planet has hit 3 degrees centigrade above where it is now, an ice age is rapidly followed. So that's support for the model that it's tied in with the melting of the polar ice cap. Because every time the temperature has gone up, we've had an ice age. Last 10 cycles, we see that. So fortunately, we're 3 degrees away from that, but that's what the global warming people are saying. It won't be long before we hit that 3-degree limit.
Hi, my name is Andrea Klink, and I am so honored and excited to meet you and to be a part of Reasons to Believe. I've been a Christian since I was about 5 years old and love the Lord. And my majors in school were math and science. And, okay, math, science over here, Christianity over here. And with your book, Creation of Science, put them together, it was like, ooh. I mean, it was like so exciting. It's like, okay, they're together. No, they're apart. They're together. No, they're apart. And it was really hard to interweave the ideas of, you know, the science world and the Bible. Now, my question is, in they talk about the mark of the beast being 666. I have a theory. It is an 18-digit number. Six numbers, six digits, six digits. That's 18 digits, and that's enough for everybody in the whole world to have 666. And it would be an implant in the back of your hand, just like we do the animals now so we can find them, or in the forehead, which is, you know, what the Bible says. And if you don't have that implant, you know, your whole financial and all your information is in that. So if you don't have it, then you can't buy at the grocery store because you have no source of and also would have the implant would have like a GPS, so they would know where everybody is. What do you think about the idea of the 666 being an 18-digit number?
Well, that was actually seriously proposed by the Club of Rome back in the early 1970s. And they basically made the point that if we could institute a number system that was implanted, and this is before the technology existed, they calculated that it would boost the world economy by at least 20%.
Mm-hmm.
10% they attributed to the fact that there would be no expense in cash transfers. Everything would be automatic, done with computers, and just, you know, how much of our economy is basically handling cash or running credit cards.
Mm-hmm.
So they said we could eliminate that, but the other big factor is the elimination of crime. And, you know, we're facing a crisis today where people are basically able to, you know, skim these credit cards, and now we got identity theft. And so how can you solve that? Well, if we had implants, that would eliminate the possibility that people could, you know, get your information off of your plastic card. Now they've got to get you, which is a little bit harder. So others have pointed out that it wouldn't eliminate all financial crime, but it would certainly eliminate quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And they basically are saying, you know, this would make a huge boost to the world economy. And maybe that's how this Bible prophecy will be sold. This is going to make you richer and wealthier. But, of course, the downside is if there's a government agency that has control over all this, they could take away your rights. And that's what the Bible predicts, that there's going to be a dictator who will basically use this system to strip the world's population of its rights and basically oppress the entire population of the world.
Right.
Where, you know, if you don't do what he says, you don't get to eat.
Yeah, it's the mark of the beast.
Yeah,
there's actually that commercial where they staple the credit card to his forehead, and they're trying to scan him. The man,
Well, you know, we have a chip on our dog, and it's really neat. If the dog gets loose, we know exactly where the dog
is. Right.
So that little GPS thing is real handy. I know a lot of parents who really would like to do that to their teenage children, but it is against the law. You're not allowed to put that into your children.
Okay.
Maybe you're going to expand on that in case, in the back of your mind, I'm not sure if this was there, you were thinking about people taking the number or the implant and then being afraid that maybe they, you know, were thereafter condemned because of unexpectedly taking that the number 666. You've commented to you on the fact that nobody will do that without realizing what they're doing.
Right. What it predicts in the Bible is that the only way you can get that number is to publicly declare that this world dictator indeed is God. He's going to set himself up as a God to be worshipped. And if you want the number, then that's the only way you're going to get the number, and everybody's going to realize exactly what they're doing. They're basically transferring their allegiance from the one that created the universe to this human dictator. But if you don't do that, you won't be able to buy or sell. You won't be able to eat or drink. You're going to have to somehow live off the land. But frankly, I don't want people knowing where I am every minute of the day. So, well, I think that's what will happen, is that people who don't want to declare that this man is God and, abandon their allegiance to the one that created the universe, they're going to have to fend for themselves somehow. But it also says when they head for the hills or, you know, dissipate, they're going to lead a huge number of people to faith in Jesus Christ. So it's going to be a time where a lot of people say, you know what, I'm not giving my allegiance to this human being. Look what he's doing to us. He's taking away all our rights, and they don't want to be caught up in that scenario. So,
does that come under the science of the Bible?
Well, it comes under the prophecies in the Bible. It basically predicts what's going to happen just before Jesus Christ returns here to planet Earth. And basically what it tells us is that God's going to shake people up. There are a lot of apathetic people running around and say, you know, Christianity sounds good, but why take it seriously? And what the Bible tells us is that God's going to allow people to see what can happen when you abandon faith in the one that created the universe and just how evil things can get. I mean, Nazi Germany is a good example. You had an atheist there who took over the whole country and basically was forcing people to live the way he intended, and it really scared people, and a lot of Germans became Christians as a direct result. So evidently, things are going to one day get that bad. But the whole idea is Jesus will not return until the greatest number of people have the opportunity to receive him as Lord and Savior. And if he has to disturb people a little bit to make that happen, then so be it. But the promise is now is the day of salvation, and if you give your life to Jesus Christ, he will protect you from the coming disasters that are predicted in this book.
Okay, let's get back to real science now. Sorry. I read this a couple of days ago. The Kepler telescope has found that the universe is actually teeming with Earth-like planets.
Right.
And that's just our galaxy.
Right.
So that means that, if that's true, that means that one out of five, I think, as a possibility of Earth-like and Goldilocks-like
right.
Attributes. And they said that some of those could certainly have life attributes to the creation of life. So what do you say about that?
Yeah, that was announced at the last American Astronomical Society meeting, the latest results from Kepler, suggesting that maybe as many as one in five planetary systems would have a planet that would be, quote, Earth-like, and they call it a Goldilocks planet. Now, Kepler, keep in mind, has been observing our solar neighborhood, and it's our solar neighborhood that is especially planet-rich. So our models of our galaxy tell us if you go farther out in our galaxy or closer to the center, you're not going to have anywhere near the density of planets. But that would, and by the way, at the American Astronomical Society meeting, they did make that qualification, one in five within the solar neighborhood. And they also carefully defined what they meant by an Earth-like planet or a Goldilocks planet. That is a planet that has the possibility, not the probability, but the possibility of having liquid water on its surface. And I'm surprised the number is as low as one out of five. I was expecting a much higher number. Maybe we'll come up with a higher number because, you know, water is the second most abundant molecule in the universe. And in our own solar system, we see a lot of bodies that are very water rich. In fact, Earth is one of the most water poor bodies in our solar system. The moons of Jupiter and Saturn are far more water rich than our planet Earth. And those planets that are orbiting close to Jupiter, for example, Europa is orbiting close enough to Jupiter that tidal heating has a potential of making the interior water within that moon in a liquid state. So it's possible we got a moon and maybe several moons in our solar system that have more liquid water on it than the Earth does. Because, for example, Europa is calculated to be 35% water. Callisto is calculated to be 65% water. The comets are 80 to 85% water. So the moons of Saturn probably got even more water, most of it in a frozen state. But if you get the appropriate amount of tidal heating, and by the way, at this American Astronomical Society meeting, they also included planets orbiting their stars where they got tidal heating that would make the interior water in a liquid state. Now, that's a long ways from having a planet with the possibility of supporting life. That's simply a planet with a possibility of having liquid water on its surface or its interior. Now, the problem is you've got a lot of astronomers at that meeting who think if you've got liquid water, you're going to have life. Well, I mean, take a kettle, boil the water, leave it alone, and see what happens to it. Pasteur did that experiment 150 years ago. You don't get life. All you get is liquid water. So liquid water is certainly a requirement for life, but it's not the only requirement for life. And most of the planets they were talking about would be like Europa, where it's in a frozen state, but the tidal heating makes the interior water liquid. And I wrote a chapter on that in Origins of Life. It's a book that's over there. Well, maybe not. We do have some? Okay, great. Where I make the point in talking about Europa that there are certain nutrients that life needs that can only be manufactured on the surface of the moon or the planet. And so the problem is, how do you get those nutrients into where the liquid water is? In the case of Europa, we know the ice is at least 26 kilometers thick, which is far too thick for the nutrients crucial for the survival of life to get through the ice down to the liquid water. So you've got I call it the oxidants-antioxidants paradox. That if you got oxidants, life can't originate, but if you don't have oxidants, life can't survive. And so frozen moons or frozen planets with liquid water in the interior are not candidates for life. You really need it on its surface. Well, this actually came up when I had the dialogue with Deborah Harzma. She's an astronomer like I am, and she was at that meeting and said, you know, Hugh, one out of five, that's a big number. We're looking at probably billions of planets that are Earth-like. And I said, well, okay, that gives you, what, maybe 10 or 11 zeros after the one. But if you look at all the features that must be in place for life to possibly exist, you need 1,000 zeros. And so I'll take off 10 or 12 zeros off your list. It isn't going to make much difference. So
who calculated the number for us, for this planet to be, to have Earth in the first place?
Well, if you're looking at what's the probability, if you don't want to invoke God performing miracles, what's the probability that you're going to find a planet, not just in our galaxy, but anywhere in the entire universe, that would have the possibility of supporting bacteria for 3 months or less? Now, that really drops the probabilities down, because now you don't have to recycle nutrients. We're only talking bacteria living for 3 months, not a year, just 3 months. The probability is less than 1 chance in 10 to the 350th power, assuming that the observable universe contains 100 billion trillion planets. Now, that's a pretty optimistic number. Even with that number, only 1 chance in 10 to the 350th power. Now, if you're talking about a planet that can sustain bacteria for 3 billion years or more, now you've got to recycle nutrients. The probability drops to less than 1 chance in 10 to the 556th power. So that adds 200 more zeros after the 1. So my whole point is liquid water is only one requirement. You've got several hundred more that have got to be in place for life to be possible. So I fully agree. I think we're going to find billions of Goldilocks planets. But a Goldilocks planet is not a planet that's necessarily a candidate for the possibility of life.
Hugh, anytime this topic comes up, I just switch to our sun and ask him, okay, show me the sun that can support life. Because as we've determined, there is no single star that is stable as our sun. So even if you have that life, the next year the sun's going to get a couple percent brighter, a couple percent dinner, and the planet is either fried or totally frozen, and it's totally sterilized again. So until you find a twin of our sun, you can find as many planets as you want, is what I tell them. It's useless.
You know, I have friends that have devoted their entire life to searching for the signals from extraterrestrial intelligent life that they think exist in other planets. And I've told my friends there that, wait a minute, why are you looking at these planets when you already know that these planets are orbiting stars that are non-candidates? And stars are easy to observe. They're really big, bright objects. And we can measure them with a lot more precision than we can measure these planets. And, you know, and Dave is right. Until we find a star that's got the necessary characteristics for advanced life, you might as well save the telescope time. I'd much rather we use that telescope to learn more about the physics of galaxies than to search for extraterrestrial intelligence signals. So, and here's my real fear. I've done radio astronomy work, and every once in a while you get a wow signal. In fact, there's in the scientific literature what they call the wow signal, where they got a signal that was 6 times above the noise. And they said this has certainly got to be from an intelligent civilization. But they continued observing in that part of the sky, and no more signals. Well, it's a principle that all of you have learned who have done any surfing. You go to the beach, and you kind of wait for a big wave to come in. And if you're a surfer, what you realize is that, say, the waves are 3 feet high on the average, every 10,000th wave will be 12 feet high. So if you want a big wave, all you got to do is wait for 10,000 waves to go by. And, you know, that's 4 times above the background noise. And so if you keep looking at these planets, you will get a signal that's 6 or 7 times above the noise simply by pure chance. It's simply the surfer waves effect. So I've told my friends who are involved in this, until it's 20 times above the noise, you don't have a case. So you need to look for signals at that level. And moreover, I think Dave is right. If you don't have a star, forget about trying to find life on a planet orbiting that star. Unless the star is almost exactly like our sun, there's no possibility that a planet could orbit it with advanced life on it. Maybe a planet with bacteria that survives for a month or two, but certainly not advanced life. We really are alone. By the way, when I debated Victor Stenger at Caltech, That's one point we both agreed on. Earth is the only place where there's intelligent life.
Amen.
It doesn't exist anywhere else. Everywhere we look in the universe, it's hostile. This is the only friendly place we see.
It sure seems to reveal the bias of the news media. They're just ready to jump on if there's water, there's life.
Well, I especially appreciated the comments of Stephen Hawking, who said, you know, we humans are really messing up our planet. We're doing a lot of damage to our planet. We need to move. We need to leave Earth and find another planet. The problem is there is no other planet that we know of. In fact, one of the things that my friends that are involved in the search for extraterrestrial intelligent life have done, they've ruled out every star system within 250 light years. So trying to leave our planet and traveling more than 250 light years away, you'll be extinct before you get there.
Before I get to my question, actually my wife looked up in the Affordable Care Act, and near the 1,000th page, it gives the secretary authority to implement a program that provides a second means of identification, being a EM chip. So that's written into that law, that it's not demanding it, but it gives the secretary discretion to impose that requirement on the population of the United States.
Okay.
I had a...
Did you read all 999 pages before find that?
I don't think anybody has.
No, she did a word search, and it's near page 1,000. I could ask her for the specific page if you want to know next Sunday. My question was something that somebody brought up as an accusation instead of a question at one of the debates that you held. This was the one you had with Lewis Wolpert in Britain. And he was such a poor candidate in the debate that I wouldn't bring up his points to question. But this one person came up with an angry accusation, and therefore it didn't get addressed as a question. And her accusation was in response to your pointing out that among the world's religions, Christianity is the one that invites and accepts testing of our faith. And her accusation was that in the world's history, in Christian history, you know, say take Europe with the persecution of Jews over the history of Europe in different regimes and any other bad actors within the church. Mm-hmm. How does Christianity offer an apologetic for those behaviors weighed against the teachings in the Bible?
Well, what was most interesting about that debate in Britain is that Lewis Wolpert also heard that angry response. And, you know, we had a conversation afterwards where he says, you know, that's absurd. He says, you heard me say in the debate that I think Christianity is wrong, but Christianity is good. And he thought that lady was just simply not aware of history. This is, if you look at history, Christianity has been a force for good. So, he says, I'm an atheist, but no doubt that Christianity has been a force for good. And his point was this. Sure, you've got some bad apples within the Christian community. I mean, you know, the Inquisition was brought up. But if you actually look at the Inquisition, number one, it was perpetrated by people that, according to the Bible, were not Christians. Not everybody who claims to be a Christian really is a Christian. Moreover, the death toll from the Inquisition, as long as it was, it went on for decades. The total death toll is 2,000 people.
That's right.
So he says, when you compare that to how many people Mao Zedong killed,
right,
or Joseph Stalin or Adolf Hitler, all three who killed in the tens of millions of people, he says, atheism has got a much worse track record than Christianity has. Right. And Christianity's got a much better track record than other religions have. I mean, if you look at Islam, for example, it's a religion of the sword. And what you see also in the New Testament is that we're not to resort to the sword. So, for example, you see in the book of Acts where certain followers of Christianity were saying, you know, we got these pagans who are doing incredibly wicked things in their temples. You know, homosexual rape and all that kind of stuff was going on. Should we, you know, put a stop to that? And notice what Paul and Peter say. They basically say, leave them alone. Christianity fosters best in a free market competition of ideas. And that's kind of the point I was trying to make in that debate with Walpart.
Raise
that very point that, you know, we Christians don't have to use a sword because we don't have to use forceful methods to try to communicate that we think we have the truth. The truth will win out. You can put it to the test. And so the worst thing for Christianity is to force people to believe certain things. The best thing is to give them the freedom to choose. So it's Christianity that's always taught freedom of religious expression. Whereas what you see in other religious systems, particularly Hinduism and Islam, is forced religious belief. Or like with Soviet Russia, it was forced religious belief in atheism. So the free market is something you tolerate when you know you got the best product. You know, companies have got a great product at a great price, they want a free market. If you've got a lousy product that you're producing at an expensive price, you're going to want a monopoly.
All right, I want to say something about that. You can't judge any movement by its worst adherents. If you look at what Christianity says, if people behave like the Bible says we're supposed to behave, Christianity is the faith that's going to produce the most peace and the most prosperity. Ted?
Hello. My question is in regard to Alan Hynek and the evidence that man gathered concerning UFOs throughout history, and in particular since World War II. Many credible aviators, radar operators, military folk have gathered information on unidentified flying objects. Then he gave a classification, encounters of the first kind, second kind through nine. And each succeeding classification is a more intimate contact with the UFO inhabitants. And it turns out when you get to the fourth level, encounters of the fourth kind and fifth kind, they become malevolent. The contacts are almost entirely degrading to the human beings. And as you pointed out, the demonic seem to have a similar bent to them in excess sexual activity of types forbidden in the Bible. And I'd like to hear your comments on the entire UFO phenomenon.
Well, I don't know whether the book is at the table or not. It is. Okay, we have it here. Lights in the Sky and Little Green Men. So it's a book I wrote with a couple of my colleagues a few years ago on this very question. And, I wound up becoming an expert in UFOs not by purpose, but by accident. Because when I was a teenager, I was heading up the astronomy club in Vancouver and said, why don't we have a booth at the Pacific National Exhibition? So we had a booth there, and I actually sold it to our club by saying we can put a bunch of our telescope mirrors that we're grinding and get people coming to our booth, and we'll tell them they can grind a mirror. And by the time we're done, we're going to have a bunch of finished mirrors. So they liked that idea. And we got a lot of people who want to practice grinding it. So that was fun. But they put our booth right next to the Flying Saucer Club. So people would visit the Flying Saucer Club booth, and they come over and talk to us. So, and I can tell you, everywhere I went when I was a professional astronomer, I got the job of handling UFO reports. And probably the most frequent UFO report I got was the planet Venus. In fact, one was really amusing. I was on the telescope one night, and we got a call from the California Highway Patrol that someone had reported to them a UFO. And so they sent a couple of cops on motorcycles to chase down this UFO. And they radioed back that they were gaining on it. So they called me and said, you know, what do you think it is? And I asked them a few questions. I said, well, they may think they're gaining on it, but they're not going to catch it. They're chasing the planet Venus. So, and if you get up early this morning, you will see the planet Venus. It's not yet at maximum brightness, but it's getting brighter and brighter. And when it's at maximum brightness, and you can only see it at maximum brightness in the early morning, never in the evening. But it can be as bright that you can read a newspaper by it. And when people see it, they often report it as a UFO. Second most common report I got was the star cluster Pleiades. especially up in Canada, because in the Pleiades rise, it actually goes horizontal across the horizon for quite some time. Yeah. And the third most common response is what I call the chandelier effect, where people actually show me a photograph of glowing lights in the horizon. I always have to ask them the question, well, were you inside a building? Oh, yeah, I took that from inside a building. I says, well, you're getting the reflection of a chandelier behind you on the window. It's being projected on the horizon. That I could show you my own private collection of UFO photographs, none of which are UFOs. Bottom line, about 99% of what people report as UFOs are not UFOs. But there's a 1% residual where it can't be explained as a natural phenomena or as a hoax or some military aircraft that's being kept in secret. And the thing about that 1% residual, the most common occurrence is 3 a.m. in the morning on lonely country roads. Not in a wilderness, but always by a small country road. Well, guess who hangs out at 3 a.m. in the morning on lonely country roads? Astronomers do. And yet astronomers have the lowest incidence of seeing UFOs. The only astronomers I know that have ever seen UFOs were two gentlemen at York University in Canada. And every time they came on our telescope, they saw UFOs. And these were two men who would maybe get 4 to 8 hours of observing time a year. And it was always a mystery. How come they keep seeing it? And I was logging 1,500 hours a year, never saw a thing. Likewise, I knew other astronomers who were logging over 1,000 hours. They never saw a thing. But these two were always seeing it. But I got to know them and found out they were very deep into occult activity. And it was from that point onwards, when anybody ever reported a UFO to me that was in that 1% category, I'd ask them questions about their occult activity. 100% correlation.
Right.
The only people I know who have had those kinds of encounters are those that have opened doors to the occult. And I especially saw that when I went to Soviet Russia, when the communists were still running the place. I would go into a physics department at a university in Russia, and about half the physicists there had seen UFOs. But they're also running a department of occult physics. The Soviets were trying to get a step up on the Americans, and so they actually had in their major universities these department of occult physics, because they were hoping to come up with occult weapons to beat the Americans. And they were actually doing experiments where they were levitating objects, but they were doing it through the power of demons. And what I noticed when I would speak to these physicists is just how terrified they were of these angelic beings. You know, here in America, you get a lot of physicists who don't believe in God. They don't believe in angels. In Soviet Russia, they all believed in God, and they all believed in angels because they saw it all around them. There were demon-possessed people right in their own physics department. So they didn't have doubts. But I'll tell you what was most amusing is that when I first went to Soviet Russia, they had me speak in halls of scientific atheism. And I was told the first time I went there, you can only speak to scientists with PhDs. If we catch you talking about your Christianity to anybody who doesn't have a PhD in science, we'll immediately deport you and you'll never be allowed back. So I said, okay, I'll just talk to people with PhDs in the sciences. And the whole idea was they knew they couldn't stop them from thinking about Christianity because they actually get visas to go to scientific meetings outside of the country. But they're really trying to control just that group. But I tell you what I heard from all those scientists there. We didn't need you to come and give a lecture to tell us that there's a God. It says every Friday we get a two-hour lecture on scientific atheism. And there's nothing like getting a lecture for 2 hours every Friday to convince you there really is a God. So if our government's got to work that hard to convince us there's no God, there's got to be a God. So that was quite remarkable. But the reason why there was so much UFO activity in Russia is because of the degree of occult activity. It has dropped considerably now that the Soviets are no longer running the show. It's still there at a much higher level than it is here. But that's something else you'll see in our book there. we actually show you the higher the level of occult activity in a nation, whether it be Brazil or France or the Soviet Russia, then the higher the number of people are having these close encounters with UFOs. And the gentleman mentioned Alan Hynek. What he did is said, forget about everybody who thinks they see UFOs. I'm only going to count the close encounters. Close encounter, the first kind, 500 feet or less, you have a contact with something that people identify as a UFO. A close encounter, the second kind, is where you got crash evidence, where a UFO crashes into the ground, melts the snow, depresses the ground, but never leaves any artifacts. Which explains why one of my professors, Carl Sagan, said UFOs don't exist. Carl Sagan, being an atheist, denied the existence of non-physical reality. The thing you see at these crash sites, it depresses the ground, melts the snow, damages the vegetation, but there's no debris, no artifacts. It moves through the atmosphere at velocities as high as 25,000 miles an hour, and there's no friction. You don't see any heat friction like you do with the shuttle coming through the atmosphere, and no sonic boom. If it was a physical object, you'd get a sonic boom, you would get heat, friction, and there'd be debris left at the crash site. But the fact that you see a depressed crater and melted snow tells you something really happened. It's real, but it's not physical. And that's the angelic realm. It's real, but it's not physical. Anyway, you can check the book. And I think the best way to put this to a test, if you take all the occult stuff out of your life, that will put an end to your UFO encounters. And I've told people who see UFOs, I says, that's all you got to do. Just get this stuff out of your life, and it'll never happen to you again. And, you know, Ted, who came to the microphone, or it was you that came to the microphone. Ted did, okay. Is that when you get into a close encounter, the third kind, that's where they actually speak to you. And the fourth kind is where you get hurt. The fifth kind is where you get killed. So that's kind of the category of listings. And people actually have been killed by these encounters. The best you're going to come away from with one of these close encounters is recurring, terrifying nightmares. That's the best scenario. So when I run into people who've had these experiences, they're quite eager to get rid of them. And there's an easy way to get rid of them. And if you don't believe me, then just check out people who have all this occult stuff in their life. Chances are they're seeing UFOs. And people who don't have occult stuff in their life, they're not. And that was the case when I was on the Algonquin Radio Observatory. The astronomers who didn't have occult activity in their life never saw anything happen. Those that did saw it happen every time they went on the telescope. By the way, I did see something once on the telescope that you might think it was a UFO. It was back in the 1960s. A very fast-moving craft came zooming across the sky, stopped over a telescope, and hovered, and messed up our observations. So we called NORAD headquarters, because our telescope was just 60 miles away from NORAD headquarters, and said, please tell your pilots not to fly by our telescope. I know they're curious, and they're wondering what this is doing in the middle of the wilderness, but please tell them not to come by. And they said, we do not have anything like that. Flatly denied that they had jet aircraft that could hover. Well, a decade later, we realized they really did have aircraft that could hover. They didn't want anybody to know about it. Well, I don't know how we got rid of them. We called the Ottawa newspapers, where the Soviet embassy was. Once it got in the newspaper, we had no more flybys.
Hugh, I'm sorry, but we're out of time.
Oh, no.
Yeah, Jocelyn's been there forever. Do you want to take one more question?
Mine was really about what you've already mentioned, but just that some people say that I think we've already talked about this, the universe is teeming. It used to be teeming with life, even though life is only on planet right now, Earth right now. It used to be teeming with life, and you've already said it. But answer that simple question.
Make it short, though.
Oh, yeah, I'll just say this. I've been on record in print since 1988. We will find the remains of life everywhere within our solar system. And when that life is found, people are going to jump to the conclusion life has got to be everywhere in the universe. The reason why we're going to find it everywhere in our solar system is because how prolific life is here on planet Earth. Our planet has exported its remains of life to all the solar system bodies. That happens whenever a large meteorite strikes the Earth. It causes Earth's soil to leave the gravity of the Earth. And there's a lot of that stuff that's floating around our solar system. The moon, for example, has got a minimum of 20,000 pounds of Earth's soil on every 100 square kilometers. And every ton of Earth's soil has 100 quadrillion bacteria in it. So it's simply a matter of time before we find the remains of life on the moon and Mars and other solar system bodies. By the way, when NASA sends a craft to Mars, it's loaded with bacteria and loaded with fungal spores. So we've already contaminated Mars by sending spacecraft there.
Thank you, Dr. Ross. Let's all say thank you.